My guest is Tova Wang. She's just written a report about caging, deception, intimidation, voting machine allocation, and other problems that threaten to disenfranchise voters in 10 swing states. The report is jointly sponsored by Common Cause and the Century Foundation. Wang is the vice president of research at Common Cause. Why is challenging someone's right to vote sometimes used as a political tactic?
Well, here's the way it works. I mean, usually a party or a group or even individuals will send out a mailing, and they will send that mailing just to people in a certain community that they know is a demographic that typically votes for the party that they oppose. And any piece of mail that comes back as undeliverable from that community, they will put that person's name on a list, and they will use that list either to challenge the person's eligibility to be on the registration rolls, or they will actually take that list with them on election day and challenge people's right to vote at the polls. The interesting thing about this is that the groups and individuals who do this tend to make big announcements that they're doing it when they do, which makes a lot of people suspect that it's not actually because they really think that there are all these ineligible voters who are going to come out and vote, but rather it's meant to make people nervous about voting and think that they might be challenged or have problems at the polls when they turn up on election day. And so it's become quite controversial.
That technique that you've described is what is known as caging.
That's right.
And which are the groups that are being targeted in these cagings?
Well, in Montana, it is being undertaken by the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party contends that they are targeting Democrats. The Republicans say that they are targeting people who have filed change of addresses but have not changed their voter registration, and that they happen to be predominantly Democrats. Typically, unfortunately, minority neighborhoods will be targeted for this kind of activity. That's been sort of the traditional route to go.
Have there been any states that have made efforts to legally prevent caging as a way to manipulate the vote?
Well, no state has completely eliminated it as a possibility, but there are states who have made it more difficult to abuse the practice of caging and challenges. Actually, the model law for this, in my estimation, is in New Mexico, where they actually do not allow just any voter to challenge the voting rights or the eligibility of another voter, but restrict it to the Secretary of State or the county party chair or 20 voters in a group to challenge. And only on election day itself, only poll workers are allowed to challenge voters, not other voters. And in a piece of good news, I think, in this election cycle, having experienced mass caging and challenges in the 2004 election, Ohio actually changed their law on this. And the Secretary of State has even taken further action to try and improve it even more. Now, under Ohio law, you're not allowed to challenge someone within 20 days of the election, and they will have a hearing, and you know, various procedures will have to be undertaken. And then on election day itself, the only people, again, like New Mexico, the only people who are allowed to make challenges to other voters on election day are poll workers, not other voters. So you won't have the situation where groups will be claiming that they will have people there, you know, for the purpose of challenging other voters on election day. And that was a real step in the right direction.
There's a lot of new voters who registered this year. What are some of the challenges you're afraid they might face?
Well, one of the concerns that we have is that there are so many people registering, and even now as the registration deadlines are coming this week and have already passed in some places, the election administrators are having a real challenge processing them all, more so in some states than in others. And so there is real concern that a lot of these new voters will not end up on the voter registration list in time, especially for early voting, because, you know, in some of these states, they start voting, well, in a few they've started already, and then several more will be in the coming weeks. And it's of even more concern in those states that are taking these voter registration forms and putting them under a microscope that's really delaying the process and rejecting voter registration applications in a way that is not doing any productive good and is threatening the disenfranchisement of a number of voters. And I point particularly to Florida, where this has come up. In Florida, they are requiring that the information that a voter puts on their registration application exactly match the information that the state already has in their DMV records or Social Security Administration records. And this has already resulted in well more than 7,000 people having their voter registration forms initially rejected. And it's usually for silly things like typos were made in the processing of the application. Someone may have used a different variation of their name, you know, David or Dave, or put in a middle name where they don't have a middle name in the other forms. And so this is becoming a real problem there, both in that people may end up coming to the polls and only being able to cast a provisional ballot. It's also a problem in that I suspect that it is slowing down the process of getting all those voter registrations, processing them, and putting people on the list.
So in a place like Florida, where voter eligibility is being challenged because there's a slight discrepancy between how they registered to vote, the way they gave their name there, and the way it's on other records in the state, are there partisan reasons behind that? Or what's the political motivation behind that?
You know, I can't really divine anybody's intentions behind this. I know that the Secretary of State there and the governor there defend the law as being necessary to make sure that there is no voter fraud, although we have no evidence that there has been any voter fraud of the kind that they're talking about trying to preventing in the state of Florida. But the truth is that this is not a very good process to ensure that there is not voter fraud, and it is a very good process for potentially disenfranchising thousands of voters. And so I take them at their word that they think that this is an essential process to undertake, but my estimation of the balance of good and harm is that they are doing much more harm with it than any good they might possibly be doing.
One of the groups that risks having its votes challenged is students mm-hmm. who often have two addresses, the home address where they're from and the address where they're living in the city that they're attending college. So what risks do they face at the polls?
Well, you know, this is not a new phenomenon, but we are seeing it already happen across the country, students being challenged as to their right to vote based on the allegation that they are not true residents of the community in which they go to school, which for most students simply is not the case. And the most recent, most sort of egregious example of this was in Virginia, where this has happened before, where the State Board of Elections continues to this moment to have a questionnaire on their website implying that students are risking their financial aid and scholarships and status as a dependent on their parents' tax returns and their health insurance and all these kinds of things if they register to vote from school in Virginia, none of which is true for these student voters. If a student considers where they go to school, their community, and where they are residents, then they are absolutely able and have the right to vote from their school.
The turnout for this election is expected to be very large. In Ohio in 2004, there were several polling places where the lines were hours long. And I'm wondering if there has been any attempt to make sure in this election that in Ohio and other places there is an adequate number of voting machines.
Well, ironically, it has been, to some degree at least, in Ohio, but in most states it certainly has not. Most states do not have any kind of state standard for the minimum number of voting machines you must have for a certain number of voters. And so it's a completely local decision on how many voting machines will be purchased and how they will be distributed. And, you know, in fairness to election administrators, one of the big problems is we have all these new voters, which we've all been hoping for, and we don't have any new money. And so we have the same number of machines, most likely, in most places, except where they have made allocations at the state or local level for more machines. And so we also don't know how they're going to be allocated. On Ohio specifically, the Secretary of State there issued a directive asking the counties to have one machine per every 175 voters, which is a pretty good ratio. And she asked that counties who were not going to use that formula publicly disseminate what their plans are for allocation of voting machines.
This election is happening during an incredible mortgage crisis and economic crisis. So many people have lost their homes in foreclosures. How might that affect their ability to vote?
Well, there are sort of two things going on there. One is the fear that lists of people who are in foreclosure proceedings will be drawn up and used as a basis to challenge people's eligibility to vote. And the fact that someone is in foreclosure proceedings is not at all a good indication of whether they are eligible to vote or not. First of all, because even if you're in foreclosure, it usually takes a year or more to actually then leave your house and move. And also because under most state laws, you are allowed to use that your old polling place as the place from which you vote if you have moved within a certain period of the election and within a certain geographic range of where you lived before. The more serious concern in some ways is that because of the foreclosure crisis, even more Americans than usual may have moved recently. And especially if they've moved out of state or far away from where they were living before, not have realized that they need to re-register. And so the concern is that a lot of people will assume that their registration has moved with them, and hopefully someday we'll have a process by which voter registration is not so much of a burden on the citizen, but actually will be a government responsibility to a greater degree. But right now, that's not the case. And so that these people may show up at the polls and not realize that they're not registered.
Some states now require voter ID at the polls in order for you to vote. What are some of the battleground states that require that now, and what kind of issues is that presenting?
Well, identification rules vary tremendously by states, and people should know that in about half the states, there's a very minimal ID requirement. But the number one state on the list in this regard is Indiana. Indiana has the most strict ID law in the country, and it is now considered a swing state. In Indiana, every voter is required to produce a government-issued photo ID at the polling place in order to vote. This, generally speaking, means a driver's license. And so that anyone that doesn't currently have a driver's license is basically left at this point to scramble to somehow get one, which means they have to produce a birth certificate in most cases, an original copy. And so if they don't have that birth certificate, they're going to have to navigate the system and pay for it and then go to a DMV or a Board of Elections to get the proper identification card that they will need to vote. This is obviously something that will disproportionately impact minorities and particularly students and older people who will not have an Indiana driver's license. The other part of the problem with the identification issue is that in the last couple of election cycles, we've seen tremendous confusion over ID and poll workers asking people or demanding ID that is not required.
You know, sometimes during elections, there are rumors that are spread that keep people from going to the polls because they're afraid that they're going to be ineligible to vote or that they will be punished in some way.
Right.
So what are some of the rumors you're hearing this year, particularly in the swing states?
Traditionally, they've been flyers that give misinformation about the voting process, and we're seeing this again in Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia area this year. A flyer in black communities being distributed that implies that if you have any outstanding parking tickets and you go to vote, they will be there waiting for you to arrest you. And this is not unusual. We see those kinds of flyers every year. There's a whole email rumor going on about whether you can or cannot wear campaign clothing to the polling place when you go to vote on election day. And in fact, actually, that is a state-by-state and often county-by-county determination. And so it is actually something people need to inquire into a little bit. You know, other things that we've seen in recent elections are robocalls the night before the election telling people that their polling place has changed, completely false. And so, you know, I have every expectation, given that it's already started and given the closeness of this election, that those kinds of tactics will be used again.
Is it ever possible to trace those misinformation flyers to the source?
They haven't been so far. And I think part of the problem is that law enforcement on all levels has been not very engaged in investigating and prosecuting people behind that. It's difficult to find the people in the first place, and I understand that. They are also hamstrung by the fact that, and this comes as a great surprise to people, but there is no federal law, and in most cases, no state law, that directly criminalizes this kind of behavior. Ironically, Senator Barack Obama, back in 2005, introduced legislation called the Deceptive Practices Bill that would have criminalized this kind of activity and required certain measures be taken to ensure that the communities affected be given the correct information immediately. A handful of states have their own laws on this, but most don't. Although people should realize that to the extent that they are used to intimidate voters or are racially discriminatory, there is the Voting Rights Act that can be used. But that is an area that is typically not pursued as it should be.
Tova Wang, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tova Wang is the Vice President of Research at Common Cause. Her report, Voting in 2008, 10 Swing States, was a joint project of Common Cause and the Century Foundation. You can find a link to the report on our website, freshair.npr.org.